From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
Every business has a business plan. That's not a lofty 24-page business plan. It's a bunch of slides and a spreadsheet. And then we question every now and then whether we're thinking big enough about that particular business or not.
I'm Connor Carney, and that's the voice of Norman Crowley, founder and CEO of the Cool Planet Group. Norman is a serial entrepreneur who founded and sold three businesses for a combined $750 million, and all before the age of 40. In 2010, Norman founded energy efficiency company Crowley Carbon, which now employs 250 people across offices in 20 countries and boasts an impressive client list, which includes Intel, PepsiCo, and Johnson & Johnson. More recently, Norman launched Electrify, which creates world-class hypercars by converting classic luxury cars such as Ferraris, Lamborghinis, and Aston Martins into high-performance electric vehicles using Tesla components. In this conversation, we talk about Norman's short-lived early retirement, why having a mission in business is critical for success, and how to make money while doing good for the planet. I started off by asking Norman to tell me about the mission of the Cool Planet Group.
It centers around climate change, really, or to use a fancy term that we've started to use in the last year, existential risk. Our job is to make money by solving existential risk in the world. So existential risk are those things in the world that can kill the whole lot of us, basically. Mm-hmm. And the kind of top three are nuclear proliferation, which we don't do much about. And then number two is germs, as we're experiencing at the moment, so pandemics. And then number three is climate change. And so we mainly work on climate change. And in particular, in climate change, we work on energy, transport, and food. So they're the kind of three areas that we work on. So we wake up in the morning and try and make money, but try and make sure that we as a human race don't fuck up the whole thing.
Within those three areas, energy, transport, can you give me a breakdown of what kind of activities you're doing within those different businesses?
So in energy, we have Crowley Carbon. Crowley Carbon operates in 23 countries around the world, and it principally works on energy efficiency and solar. So the world, if you look at the world of factories and big buildings, they waste $3 trillion a year in energy. So we basically go to all this trouble of taking fossil fuels out of the ground, and then we waste 80% of them, which is a shocking situation. And so that business, it's a bunch of businesses. It's got 23 different subsidiaries, everywhere from Sao Paulo to Sydney. And we do energy efficiency. So for our biggest client, we save them about $100 million a year in energy. And we have four of the top five food companies in the world, seven of the top eight pharmaceutical companies, some big oil companies as clients. And so that's the energy business. And that's the biggest business. It's been going 10 years. It's got about 250 people. And then transport. Transport, as you may know, if you see Tesla share price rocketing and electric transport going through the roof, is the one of the hottest sectors in the world, because the world is going to go electric between 2020 and 2030. Mm-hmm. And it's quite difficult to get into that space, because if you don't have Tesla's money, that scale, then it's tricky. So we've come in an interesting way where we electrify classic cars. So we've got a bunch of businesses in that space. We've got a factory in Wales called ECC that's got its own TV show on Discovery Channel. And then we've got Electrify, which converts more expensive cars, like between 100,000 to 750,000. That's the business that everyone looks at and says, that's a funny little business. I'm sure that'll never work. And yet the next delivery date for a car is March 2022 at the moment. So it's been sold out since the very beginning. Yeah.
Who is it? Give me a shape of a customer who's buying a car for 750,000.
You'd imagine somebody who's rich. car collectors. Well, if you take a step back on that industry, classic cars, a lot of people don't realize that classic cars are an asset class, right? So you can buy a painting, you can buy a vintage watch, you can buy a classic car. And the reason people do that is because the value of a euro and the value of a dollar is devaluing all the time, because how we solve a problem like COVID is we just print more money, and therefore a euro is not worth what it was before the start of COVID. So people buy cars, and cars since 2006 until today have been appreciating by 21% a year. So classic cars. So if you go out and buy a Hyundai in the morning, it'll depreciate by 10-12% a year minimum, whereas these are appreciating by 20-something%. But the problem with them is they're old and they are unreliable because they're old. And so what we do is we take the engine and gearbox out and we carefully put them in a box, and then we replace them with electric motors. And so we take a classic car from 1900 moving parts to 90. And then it becomes an ultra reliable, fun asset, twice as fast, way cheaper to run. And then when you're selling the car, you can either put the engine and gearbox back into it, or you can sell it with the engine and gearbox. So your asset is still protected. So a lot of it is car collectors, hotels. So big push in for electric Land Rovers at the moment, strangely, for hotels around the world. But you name it. And it's not necessarily rich people. Obviously, our ECC business in Wales does like Fiat 500s, you know, so our Minis or Beetles, and it does bigger cars too. Whereas then our electrified business does much more expensive cars.
I've heard you talk a lot about being mission-led and being driven by this mission. How important is that in running and growing a business in general?
Look, it's everything, you know, and it doesn't, in our case, it's kind of grandiose mission because it saves people's lives and that. But even a mission, you know, like your business, like you can be mission led in your business, right? If your mission is to do good accounting services and give people really good advice and make their lives easier, that's a really good mission, right? But if you wake up in the morning and you say, I want to make a shitload of money, then that's not a great mission, right? whereas if you deeply care for your customers and you want to see them win, then you'll do it incredibly well because that's what works. Yeah. Whereas if it's like, I don't care about any of that, I just want to make money, then, you know, nobody really wants to work with you. You know, it's not that interesting. So it doesn't have to be a kind of major lofty one, but it does have to be there. And if you're not mission led, then you're not, you know, your business just isn't that interesting.
Do you think that it helps filter down through the organization in hiring staff and getting people on board? Is the mission something that everyone can kind of strive towards?
Yeah, but it has to come from the top, which is obviously the boss and the executives who run the business. Because if your mission says you're going to do something, but then actually day to day, everyone just operates the way they operate, then don't bother. Like, whereas if you wake up in the morning and you deeply care about whatever the mission is, then everybody gets it straight away. And people correct each other as well. They say, hey, like, that's not in line with what we're trying to do here, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you see other people in other parts of the world correcting people in the business and saying, hey, that's not aligned with what we're doing, then you know you've got something at that point, because it's very easy to preach from the top, but really it's people three quarters of the way down, you know, the people who are new to the business or whatever, they're the ones you want to see is the message getting to them.
Does that come down through the values as well? Are they integrated?
I never can tell the difference between mission and values and all that technical chronology. Yeah. For us, it's about, like, our logo says, just under it, it says cooling the planet. Mm-hmm. And that's what we do, right? And so, like, you don't need a whole lot of paperwork other than that, right? And then if you see that and then you see how the people act, then that's all you need. You know, and whereas if you have everything, you know, mission statements, values, goals, all that kind of stuff, and then nobody's living it, then don't bother. Yeah.
Can you think of a time where you saw that the values might not have been being adhered to, or what, you know, what would it look like if someone wasn't kind of on board with?
Well, look, it happens to all of us. Like, some days you wake up and, you know, you've had a couple of setbacks in the business, and you're not living the values yourself, you know, mm-hmm. and I've been corrected on that in the past, you know, and that's the way it should be. Everybody comes into work some days feeling like they just want to kick the cat, you know, and so it's a team sport, and it's up to everybody to keep everybody else aligned to it. And it's a very bad day when everyone in the company is pulling in the wrong direction, you know. Mm-hmm. But the culture, to use an overused buzzword, the job of the culture is to steer everybody. And the day you feel like shit and not aligned, somebody else will pick you up on it, and then vice versa.
Mm-hmm. How did Inspire Gaming come about?
The Inspired Gaming came about we'd sold a business in 1999, and we were looking for a new business in 2000. And a mate of mine worked in William Hill in one of their shops in the UK. And he was behind the counter, and I was looking at these machines, and I was just like, they just looked like something from the 1980s or the 1970s. And I couldn't believe they hadn't been digitized. And when he came out, I said to him, why don't you just do digital with broadband and stuff? And he was like, if you think it's so easy, why don't you do it? We didn't know anything about gaming, and we built a machine, and it was rubbish. And then we built another machine. And by the time we built the third machine, it was making four times the money of any other machine in the market. So that's how it started. That's an oversimplification of how it started. It took about a year and lots of heartache and broken machines and messing. Yeah.
did William Hill kind of sign up, you know, did they give you a contract to create a machine?
No, but the minute we created the one that worked, they gave us an order for 7,000 of them, which propelled the business from, you know, no revenue to a couple of hundred million, one contract. Yeah.
How were you getting this machine made? Did you go to a manufacturer? Did you write the software?
We went to a manufacturer, and then the manufacturer went bust because they weren't really good at making machines. And so then we bought that business out of liquidation and rebuilt it as a proper manufacturing thing with proper technologies and all that kind of stuff. And then it made good machines after that. And we didn't know anything about making machines, but by the end we knew a lot. Yeah.
And I mean, what was your mindset throughout all of this? Because I'm just trying to, you have this kind of business idea as such, which has been sparked by a bit of inspiration from your friend in the betting shop. And then you go and spend a year trying to make this machine, buying another company, you know, at some stage you must have had some doubt or that, you know, what you were doing, or were you just trying to enjoy every day as it came?
Look, you know, how you live your life is very different to what's going on in the business. And most days are a mix of absolute joy and absolute dreadful terror. And people say, you know, because you sold a business for $500 million, people say, oh, well, sure, most days must be great crack. But actually, I was up at 4 this morning because I couldn't go back to sleep because I was worried about our car business. And turned out I was worried about something I didn't need to be worried about, as it turned out, mm-hmm. which is most worries. But every day is like that, right? And it's, for us, for me and my wife, it's 7 days a week, you know, because you know, we have our own family office investments as well, and then the businesses, and we don't discern between work and not work, right? It's interesting stuff that's happening that we need to work on, you know. So, that's the one thing about being mission-led. If the mission is important, then it ain't about stopping for Saturday and Sunday. It's about just getting the mission done, yeah. In the worst business day of your career, you'll have a laugh over something. It might be a dark, morbid sense of humor, but there'll be something funny going on, yeah. You know. And then on the best day, there'll be something annoying happening, you know. So happiness, I've learned, is not related to what's going on day to day. You know, obviously, if somebody is sick or something, you're very worried about that. But other than that, your level of happiness is not linked to what's going on in the business, or shouldn't be.
So when that jump went from no revenue to hundreds of millions in revenue, was there a scramble to put some systems in place, or was it just you with this business that you had bought that's now manufacturing machines and you're a one-man business of 100 million, or how did it go?
No, we bought businesses along the way. and they had systems. In hindsight, most of the systems were crap. You know, as the business grows, you change the systems and you get bigger systems and better systems. But we bought businesses along the way. So we went from 8 people in 2001 to 2,500 people in 2006. And along the way, we bought companies and integrated them. And in hindsight, not as well as we would now, you know, but we integrated them and got it all to work together. And they had systems, and some of those systems were great and some of them weren't. So you really are, as the business is growing, you're just playing the game that's in front of you on that particular day, you know. And it is the only guiding light is that the team has to be solid, you know. And if the team is solid, then everything kind of sorts itself out eventually, yeah.
As the CEO of that gaming business, how was your kind of days and months structured? I think it was a public company at one stage, was it?
Yeah, we floated it in 2006 and then sold it to private equity in 2008. And like the average day was insane. Like you get up in the morning, Monday, fly to London, spend a week in London, fly back Thursday night. Then every third week, fly to Hong Kong, jump on a private jet, visit 7 countries, Laos, Philippines, Cambodia, places like that, because we had operations there. Then every 12th week, fly to Sydney and spend our Melbourne rather, and spend a week in Melbourne and fly home. And at the time, I was kind of, you know, by the time that all stopped, I was kind of nearly 19 stone, you know, and deeply unhealthy, which wasn't a great idea. So I think now we would manage that much better. But yeah, it's crazy times, completely crazy times. And you're a public company, so you're scrutinized all the time and you've got to report to the market regularly and everything to do with that, you know. So like I look back on that as kind of a not very healthy time for me or my mental health, but actually at the same time, it was kind of stupidly exciting. You know, I was like at the time I was 34 years old and considered hot shit.
How did that come to a head?
It came to a head because this is the kind of famous story. An Icelandic hedge fund offered to buy the business for $1 billion. We said yes. It took 7 months to do the deal. And then just before they were, like literally a couple of hours before they were due to sign on the dotted line, Lehman Brothers and all of that happened and the whole world just imploded. So our timing was out by, in truth, our timing was out by probably a month. And that became quite an awful time, you know, where we had to rejig the business and grind it out for 7 or 8 months. And it was torture, you know.
I've heard you talk about before in and around this time where you had a very bad health scare and what you kind of learned after that. Could you talk about that story just for a minute?
Yeah, we went through that time of almost selling the business for $1 billion. And then, you know, that was just a torturous 6 months. There was a lot of headwinds in the business just straight after that. And we were grinding it out. And then we got to the other side. We won a couple of major contracts and got the share price back up to where it was supposed to be. And then one day I woke up and I just couldn't feel my hand. And you know the way you think you've slept funny. But after an hour, I still couldn't feel. In fact, I couldn't feel the whole right side of my body. When they started checking me out, they thought it was something very serious, like a motor neuron disease or something like that. It was nothing good. The top 5 options of what it was going to be were all awful. That went on for a couple of weeks while they were doing tests and stuff like that. And then it turned out to be just severe stress in the end and anxiety. And so it was just you know, for anyone who suffers from anxiety, they would know that it's a very, very dark time, you know. So, yeah.
If you don't mind me asking, was kind of going through your head at the time before this, you know, did you kind of realize that you were this stressed? Were you worried about anything in particular? Was it all kind of in the future, existential crises happening, you know, keeping you up at night?
Well, the thing about anxiety is as much a physical illness as it is, you know, in your system. Like you can scientifically know why anxiety is happening, but as an emotion, it's just the sky is falling, you know, everything is awful. You know, that's not going to work. You're going to die. You know, it's all just awful. And what I learned through that was that with exercise and diet and meditation, that you can pull out of it, you know. And actually, for some people, drugs are very, very good. You learn a lot of valuable lessons about yourself and how you operate and how you can stop that from happening. And you can learn to be more disciplined. And then that makes you ultimately more useful too, because when you're disciplined, then you can just become more effective. And so strangely, not selling the business for $1 billion and being crippled with anxiety were the two best things that ever happened to me.
And so you talk about exercise, diet, meditation. Are those just things you do and kind of by osmosis, just by kind of looking after yourself in this way, you don't fall into that anxious mindset that you were in before?
Well, you fall into it as long as you stay by the guide rails. When you're anxious, you understand that you don't want to be anxious. And so when you stick to the rules, which is take it easy on the booze, take it easy on the coffee, bit of sleep, exercise, meditation, then you feel empowered all the time, you know, and you're centered and you're focused. And if you don't do those things, then you pay the price. Yeah. And that's true of any person, right? It's just, if people are listening and going, well, you know, it's not true of me. Well, it is, because that's just biology, right? You have an endocrine system and your body is the whole time firing off chemicals. And if you don't manage those chemicals, then you'll pay for it. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad I learned that. I wished I learned it 20 years earlier, but I'm really glad I learned it.
Yeah. Out of those things, what's the biggest impact, do you think, for your mental health?
All of them. And that's not smart. Like, yeah. if you eat too much, your chemicals get messed up. If you drink too much, you'll just feel like crap all the time. If you don't exercise, you don't flush all the bad chemicals out of your body. If you don't meditate, then you're an unfocused, chaotic mess. Yeah. And I'm not religious, so when you hear meditation, don't take that as a code word for anything Buddhist or weird. I have no problem with religions, and it's just not for me. It's much more about the science behind meditation is very clear. If you meditate, your frontal cortex enlarges, which is where you have everything that's to do with focus and your emotions and all that kind of stuff. You know,
how often do you meditate?
Every single day, so 20 minutes, 8 o'clock every evening. Yeah,
every evening. Do you ever? Nearly fall asleep at 8 p.m.
Very rarely. I'm not a kind of sleeper kind of guy. I could see why people would fall asleep. If you're tired, it's kind of harder to meditate. But in general, you know, they call it a practice, and it's a really accurate description. You know, if you do it every day, you get better at it, and it has more and more positive effects. You know, and it really helps with other things in work, like empathy. You know, focus, especially, like, there is no drug that would make you focus as good as meditation does. You know, you could be reviewing a spreadsheet for 5 hours and you would just do it no problem. And because of focus, you know, and I couldn't have done that before. You know?
And I don't want to spend the whole interview talking about meditation, but where does the focus come from? Is it the fact that you're clearing other ideas and thoughts out of your head in order to be able to just look and do what you're doing at that time?
I think some of it could be as simple as, if you meditate, your frontal cortex gets bigger. And if your frontal cortex gets bigger, you're able to focus more. Some people put it down to religious experiences and stuff like that. I don't really. I think if you ignore the physiology of it and you go for the mental side, what you're doing for 20 minutes is you're focusing on your breath. And focusing on your breath can be quite boring, right? It doesn't talk back and it's not a great conversationalist. So, but if you spend 20 minutes or an hour every day or whatever it might be focusing on something that's quite boring, then as a practice, it becomes, you know, you become very good at it. But like, there's a lot more to it than that. You know, some people say 10% happier. You know, what I noticed after doing it for 10 days was, like, jokes are a little bit funnier, just life's a bit lighter, you know, and problems aren't as big as they were before. Yeah, it's on my list of things that people really should open themselves up to. Yeah.
Do you think, especially for doing something in business, do you think that kind of personal management side is very important?
Yeah, it is completely important. It, you know, if you want to be successful in business and you're not exercising, watching what you eat, and meditating, then you're missing 20-30% of your performance, you know. And so why would you do that? Like, you know, and you'll be happier after you do it too, you know. So it is that simple. Yeah.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. Bring me back to when you first got started in business. What was your first business?
So when I was 15, I set up a welding company. My dad taught me how to weld. We grew up on a farm and we had no money. So my dad taught me how to weld, and then I used to weld for local farmers, and that was the first business. And then there was a lot of welding work, so then I hired some people. and then we all worked on it. And then we sold that business when I was 20, and that was the beginning. I always wanted to work in technology. So then we set up a technology company, and we had that for about 10 years. And that was the one we sold in 1999. So it started
You were 28 at that stage when you sold that business.
Yeah. I retired at 28 for about 5 minutes.
Until you jump back into your next business.
Yeah. I learned that retiring at 28 does not equal happy ever after. Yeah. That was a misunderstanding I had at the time. Yeah.
What understanding do you have now?
It's not really, you know, people say when I'm successful at this business, I will make loads of money and then I will be happy. And that's not right. Like if you might as well be happy now, because you may be a small bit happier when you have money, but not much, right? Money sorts out small things like, you know, you don't have to worry about paying your healthcare and all that, but it doesn't, you know, and there are certain things with your family and that you can sort easier, right? You know, do not equate that to happiness. Yeah. A lot of other people say, well, when I have money, I'm going to, you know, I'm going to do better for the world. Well, actually, do better for the world now. Don't bother waiting until you have more money, right? Because they're separate things, you know. And people, when they hear me say that, say that's easy for him to say, but like we set up our first charity when we had no money, right? And even now our charities, we give them money, but most of the money they raise externally, you know, because you can never give a charity enough money. So it's, you know, there are certain things like that like be happy now, don't wait until you have loads of money, you know, and they are most definitely separate things. Yeah.
What would you say is your biggest weakness that you've kind of discovered about yourself over these years in business? And have you been able to deal with that?
The one that I struggle with first, the one I struggle with is trusting my own intuition. You know? So there's still always doubt there about, is this a good idea? Especially if it's a new business, you're always second guessing that, you know. And the other one is expressing, we call it in the business being brave. It's one of our values, and it's not about being brave about jumping off a cliff. It's about being brave in communication with other people. So it's basically saying, hey, you know, and that could be anything. It could be, hey, Johnny, you didn't do a great job on that just now. What's going on? So direct communication. And I'm a lot better than I was, but there are still times when you chicken out of saying what needs to be said. Yeah. They're the two things. If you can trust your intuition and go for it, and if you can communicate with courage, then that'll go a long way, you know.
When you've gotten better, obviously, at communicating with courage, you know, in what way does that kind of creep back in? Is it with employees or is it with clients and setting expectations and things like that?
All of those. Your wife. Employees, all of it. It's everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. Like the biggest problem in business is we don't say what we mean. Yeah. And therefore people get the wrong idea and therefore everybody wastes time. And corporations, especially large corporations, are full of that. No, you know, if the culture is damaged, which sadly it is in a lot of large corporations, nobody is saying what they mean all the time. And so nobody knows what they're supposed to be doing and why they're supposed to be doing it. And when they create a product that's rubbish, nobody has the courage to tell them it's rubbish. And so they end up trying to sell rubbish products. And that's the vast majority of corporations are that way. And so if you can start off with direct communication, you just cut out so much pain, you know, and create amazing organizations. Because if you do it, then your team does it, and then they do it with their teams, and away you go. Yeah.
Do you hold trainings or anything around these things for staff members?
Yeah. Yeah. We've got one of our executives, is our secret weapon is Rita. And she's our chief people officer and chief culture officer now. And she runs culture, basically. So, and so every month we have a kind of town hall on Zoom. And every week there's something going on around culture, you know. And it could be just helping people with something, or it could be some in-your-face deep thinking that we're doing about it. Yeah.
What does your work life look like now in Crowley Carbon running this business versus what it looked like before?
Every day is different, you know, because some days you're stuck in the transport business, other days you're in energy. We've got a new education division, so we're working on that. So it's different every day. And I don't do, like, I start at 9, I finish at 7-ish. So it's not insane. Some days you don't finish until late. And like I was saying earlier, it's in general 7 days a week, because it's kind of hard to tell the difference between work and fun. But now the role is empowering the team, really. Like when it gets to a certain scale, you can't do the work, the detail anymore, you know. Like, you can do detail around numbers, around a particular product, but really most of your time is just spent with the executives and the senior team that report to the executives, and mentoring them and making sure that they're on the right track. And we're kind of strange in many ways. Like, we have a company shrink, so Simon, who's amazing. Do you ever watch Billions?
Yeah, I've seen that. I saw some of the first season. Came to mind actually when you said
So our Windy is called Simon. And Simon is a serious, very similar to the Windy character. Simon's a serious operator. Like, this is not somebody who just appears in work. And their job is coaching and the kind of deeper side of what's holding people back and that kind of thing, you know. So yeah, more and more it's about the team and getting the team to perform, and then making the team perform to the point where they become better and become wealthier and all of that, you know.
Is it a lot of, technically speaking, is it a lot of meetings, things like that? Is that what your day is mostly filled with?
Yeah. It's in the existing businesses, they're doing the meetings with the clients, and then I'm just doing the meetings with them. And then in the new businesses, I'm meeting clients. Like, in the car company, we had a stand at Salon Privé last week in London, or the week before, and we were selling very expensive classic cars to people. And so I was meeting customers and chatting to them. But then as the business gets bigger, you know, it's the team that do that work, and you're back to mentoring them again. But also, when you do a startup, you have to get into the weeds. You have to know every single nut and bolt, because as it gets bigger, if you don't know the nuts and bolts, then you're just going to get jerked around, you know.
What would you say you're best at in your
business? I have no idea anymore. I'm very good at selling.
Yeah.
Up to a point, actually. I'm crap at negotiating price. If it was up to me, I'd just give it all away for free. So at a certain point, I don't do price. So I'll get a client excited about it, and then I'll just hand it off to somebody else who's much better at price than me. So, and then I guess I'm good at inspiring people. I must be at this stage. Yeah. But it's easier to list the things I'm crap at.
Do you feel like the things that you're good at, they've obviously been an important part of what you've built, you know, in this business and in your past businesses. Did it take you time to realize that? Were you always sure of yourself when it came to dealing with people?
No, like, I'm, even now, I'm insecure. I'm insecure a lot less of the time than I used to be, but I'm insecure a lot of the time, like everybody else, right? And I think that's a human condition. If you're too secure in yourself, then you're probably a bit of a dick, you know? So no, I'm never sure. I guess I'm more sure than I used to be about certain things. But you should be questioning your capabilities all the time, because otherwise, how are you going to improve? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you say I'm the best in the world, and at that, you're probably not really. Yeah. It's a big world. So yeah.
How do you measure progress now? You know, you have this you have a very lofty mission, as you said. It's a very ambitious mission. I suppose money hasn't been a factor since you were very young. You know, what drives you now, and you know, how do you track yourself?
Well, everything we're doing has a business plan, and the business plan, that's one of the challenges, is to make sure that the business plan is lofty enough, actually, because if you grow up like with very little, and then you end up creating a business, and there are many, many businesses, even in Ireland, bigger than ours, you have to make sure all the time that your goal is worthy of the capabilities of you and the team. Mm-hmm. And that's the hardest thing, or it's one of the hardest things. It's like, if we say to you now, we're going to create one of the largest online accounting services in the world, right? So here's an interesting thing about that, right? So if you keep saying that to people, it will happen, right? But also, if you keep saying it to people, they'll try and lock you up, right? Mm-hmm. And so the courage in life is keep saying it to people, right? Because when you say it to people, some people, sadly, the majority, smirk and say, that's not going to happen. But actually, a small few will help you make it happen. And our biggest problem a lot of the time is not having the courage to explain to people what it is we're trying to do. And so I'll be really honest with you. We've been working on the cars for 18 months, and now it looks like it's going to be a blockbuster. But for the first 6 months, I would only tell a select few that we were working on it. Mm. Not because I was afraid they would tell anybody else, but because I was afraid they would think I was smoking crack, right? And that's what I mean, right? Is I should have just had the courage from day one to go, we're going to create this multi-million dollar car business. Mm-hmm. So, and I probably wasted 6 months there.
Would you tell anyone who would listen to you? Would you be getting a haircut and telling the barber?
No. I would tell my friends who I trusted what we were up to, but I wouldn't tell the barber because he'd laugh at me. Yeah. And that's really dumb, right? You should just tell the barber. Right? So the next time you're getting your haircut, just tell him, yeah, that's the mission.
Yeah. And I got one yesterday, so I'll have to wait a few
weeks.
It'll have to be the next one.
But like, that's a big, you know, people say it's really important to have goals, and it is, but it's much more important to communicate those goals and have the courage to communicate those goals, mm-hmm. because that's how you recruit allies and partners. And we're all too afraid to do that a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. And if you can do it, then success will follow. Plus you find out who your friends are.
Yeah. Do you have an exact metric, for example, for where you want to go with a particular business, or does the biggest suffice for the time being?
No, every business has a business plan. And that's not a lofty 24-page business plan. It's a bunch of slides and a spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. And then we track the business plan. And then we question every now and then whether we're thinking big enough about that particular business or not. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest challenges, is resting on your laurels and saying, aren't I a great fella for building this thing? You know, and like, if you look at our business, and a lot of people would term it successful, but look at it compared to Tesla. Like, we're a joke, you know. And so the question every day is, what is stopping us from being Tesla? You know? And predominant answer is courage, actually. And so we admire businesses like that, not because they're big, but because of what they've done and what they've overcome. You know?
Mm-hmm. What part of the business are you most excited about?
Ah, that would be like saying, which is my favorite child?
Well, I'll reshape the question. You obviously have quite a lot of ideas. You obviously have ideas that probably if you gave enough time and resources to them, they would work. Do you ever suffer from the problem of having too many ideas? And
yes. Only every 5 minutes. My wife says I'm like a chain smoker. I've got two in my mouth and one in each of my fingers. And there's a couple in the ashtray that I've got my eye on.
And is it difficult to get around that on a kind
yes.
of a, yeah, yeah.
And I'm not that good at it. We have too many businesses. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But they all thankfully work. They're all led by very good people. And so the thing that I'm getting better at inspiring them, because it's very hard to say no to a new business. Like, we've just started doing home solar in Ireland, home solar and batteries. And the reason for that is a lot of the suppliers who do it right now just aren't that good. And we found somebody to run it who's excellent. And so why wouldn't you do it then? You know, or I always wanted to get into property a little bit, residential property, but I don't have the time. But it turns out my brother and my nephew are really brilliant at it. And so why wouldn't we do that business then? You know, so that's the thing. But it's a disease. I don't think it's entirely healthy, and I don't think the emotions surrounding it are entirely healthy either.
Well, there are limitless opportunities, I suppose.
All we can see is opportunities. Yeah. Like this morning in the car business, we did up an electric Land Rover Defender for a hotel, and then they called us and ordered a second one. And it's a very cool vehicle. And then just after I got off the phone from our sales director in the car business, I was like, why don't we just market electric Defenders and electric G-Wagons to every single hotel in the world? Like, and instead of selling them to them, why don't we just lease them to them? And then if they don't have the money, we'll take it back and give it to somebody else. And you got recurring income. And electric cars don't age as badly as other cars. Mm-hmm. So you can just keep them as assets all the time. And I was like, why didn't we think of that a year ago? Yeah. Like, we've been doing this for 18 months. Like, this idea has just been sitting out there, you know. Ideas ain't the problem.
Yeah. So what does the future look like for Crowley Carbon, for Cool Planet, for the rest of the businesses? Where are you going? If you want to voice it here in public, what are your goals?
The goal is between 2020 and 2030 for the world is an extremely challenging time. First of all, because we've never had so much capability in terms of technology to mess up the whole thing. And I don't think we're getting any wiser. Right? And so part of our business is in causing the upheaval over the next 10 years. So, you know, getting energy to all renewable, all free, right? Getting transport to all electric, all free, right? And then same with food, zero carbon footprint or as low as we can get it. And then what happens when you do all that stuff is you cause massive upset. So what happens when nobody wants Russian gas and Russian oil anymore, then Russia is over there with all those nukes. What does that mean for the world? Likewise, Saudi Arabia, I don't think it has nukes, but it's got a lot of dough. And what happens when nobody's buying oil from them anymore? And then we're all watching too much bloody social media. So where's that going to end, right? And so one side of what we're doing is all about the products to enable this to happen. And the other side is making sure that in the process of doing that, we don't drive each other crazy.
Norman Crowley, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Cheers, Connor.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.